This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. My guest, Dr. Benjamin Whorf, has been named a 2012 MacArthur Foundation Fellow. He's one of four in the area who've received what we've come to know as the Genius Grant. Dr. Whorf is a neurosurgeon at Boston Children's Hospital, where he has changed the treatment of intracranial diseases in very young children. Dr. Whorf, thanks very much for joining us.
That's my privilege.
So I want to get into some of the work you did in a second, but first, I have to ask, how did you hear that you had won the MacArthur Grant?
Well, I was actually in Brazil at the time. I was at a meeting giving a series of talks and was in a hotel lobby in Rio de Janeiro waiting for my airport shuttle and got sort of a poorly connected telephone call on my cell phone telling me about it.
And at first, did you think it was a prank call? Did you think it was real?
It caught me so off guard that I'm not really sure what I thought. And it took a while to sink in, even after I got off the phone.
So as you were flying back on the plane, were you thinking, oh my gosh, I just won? Did you know that it was $500,000?
They told me on the phone, yeah.
And tell me, what has the reaction been like when you got back to Children's Hospital? What did people say to you? Was the workplace changed a little bit?
Well, the hard thing was I got a phone call 2 or 3 weeks before the announcement, and I was sworn to secrecy. I could only tell my wife, which I did, but I couldn't tell anyone else. Finally, when the announcement broke, there was a lot of congratulations and a lot of, it's just been great.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about why you won it. And you look primarily at hydrocephalus and spina bifida. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, talk a little bit about what those conditions are and how they're caused.
Right. So hydrocephalus is not just one disease. It's caused by a number of different, potentially different things. There are congenital causes where the pathways in the brain don't form properly. There are secondary causes, such as from infection or hemorrhage. Later in life, hydrocephalus can be caused by an obstructing mass, like a brain tumor. So it's the final common pathway for any process that interrupts the normal production, circulation, and absorption of the cerebrospinal fluid.
And it's manifested very often in kids with really large heads, right?
Right. So if it remains untreated in little babies, their skulls are soft and their heads are able to expand. And so the volume just builds, and it does compress the brain to a degree, but the head is flexible and is able to enlarge. And if it's not treated, it can be quite dramatic.
Now, I know you've worked a lot in Uganda on this issue. I wonder, is this a problem that is much more common in developing nations?
It really seems to be. When my family and I first moved to Uganda in 2006, where we stayed for about 6.5 years, it became quickly obvious that this was the most common problem we were going to deal with in this pediatric neurosurgery hospital that we had started with Cure International. And there are a couple of reasons why the burden of this disease is so high in sub-Saharan Africa. One is, first of all, there's a very high birth rate there. And so any congenital problem will be more prevalent just because there's so many more babies being born per capita per year. However, one of the things that we found and were the first to report early on is that neonatal infection, brain infections, cause more than half of the cases of hydrocephalus in these babies. And that's not something that we see much of in the U.S. or in other developed countries. It's quite unusual, actually.
So how big a problem is it in developing countries? Do you have any sense of what percentage of children have or go on to develop hydrocephalus?
Right. So we actually have done some estimates of that, and we think there may be somewhere around 250,000 babies in sub-Saharan Africa that develop this condition within the first year of life each year. So it's not as common as some of the really common pediatric diseases. It's not as common as HIV/AIDS, but it is a very common condition, which for the most part does not get treated because there's only one neurosurgeon per 10 million population in sub-Saharan Africa. So the vast majority of these children aren't treated. Half of them will die within 2 years, and their survivors are badly disabled. So it's really a terrible condition.
Okay. So you changed how hydrocephalus was dealt with, just the method by which doctors got in there and tried to get that fluid out. So what was the old way, and what did you try to transition it to?
The most common way to treat hydrocephalus, and really about the only way in babies that it had been being successfully treated, was by placing something called a shunt. And that is a tube that goes into the fluid chamber inside the brain. We call those chambers the ventricles. And it drains the fluid out through a tube that goes underneath the skin down to the abdominal cavity. So it continuously drains the fluid as needed. Now, the problem with shunts, and they certainly work, but they require lifelong maintenance, and they often fail. Half of shunts will fail within 2 years of placement. The average child has 2 to 3 shunt revisions over the course of time, and some children have scores of operations from multiple shunt problems.
Now, and you're dealing with places that have very few doctors, as you said, per capita, so it's hard to keep up something that's high maintenance.
That is exactly the problem. So to place a shunt in a baby who had traveled maybe a couple of days to get to us and then send them back to the bush was a recipe for disaster, because at any point in the next few years, that shunt could fail, and that's a medical emergency. Here in the States, we have the system in place to emergently care for these children, and it's rare to have a death from a shunt malfunction. But rural Africa is a completely different ballgame.
Okay, and so what was your solution that you tried to put into practice and that now is the generally accepted way of dealing with hydrocephalus?
Well, there was a method that had been being used successfully in certain types of hydrocephalus, especially in older patients, called endoscopic third ventriculostomy, which had been tried in babies, but for the most part had not been very successful. There was an old idea, which had been largely abandoned 50 years ago, of reducing some of the tissue inside the spaces in the brain that makes this fluid. That worked partially for some kids, but had largely been abandoned. For reasons that kind of made sense if you think about the physiology, it made sense that the ETV in the newborn baby may not work most of the time because they're not able to handle the fluid. Nobody had ever tried combining these two techniques. And with the new type of better imaging and better neuroendoscopy equipment we had, we were able to do this procedure through a single small opening in the baby's soft spot. And when we tried combining these two together, this so-called ETV and choroid plexus cauterization, it dramatically increased the rate of success for treating hydrocephalus endoscopically in these babies.
And has that spread all over the world? Do you see neurosurgeons all over the world using that treatment, or are a lot of people still using stents because they haven't been brought up to
right
speed?
So it's the latter. And more studies and more proof of principle need to happen, but largely people just need to learn to do it. We have a program that I started about 10 years ago where we train neurosurgeons from developing countries who are committed to treating hydrocephalus to perform this technique. We train them and equip them, and I've done that in about 20 with about 20 people in about 18 different countries through an NGO that's called Cure Hydrocephalus that now I'm a part of. But in the U.S., people are starting to pick up on this technique, and what I'm hoping to see in the next couple of years is a multi-center trial where this is the same results are replicated by other people, not just me.
I have a question. What brought you to Uganda in the first place? Obviously, you're a doctor in the U.S., pretty comfortable life. Why leave and move to Uganda for, like you said, more than 6 years?
Yeah, well, that was kind of a weird career move.
Not your typical.
No.
Right.
So, just to be completely straight about it, my wife and I felt a sense of calling to be medical missionaries. And we went with Cure International, which is a non-denominational Christian medical mission organization. And we went there for an indefinite period of time because we thought it was the kind of work God had called us to do. So we went there and helped to start this surgical hospital for children, and wound up in the middle of a lot of very interesting work and being able to do things that I had never thought that we would be doing.
And did being in Uganda for 6 years totally change your view of America when you came back?
It really did. It really, really did.
Is there a moment that you can think of when you came back where you realized how your perception had changed a bit?
Well, this is the first thing that comes to mind, and it's a bit trivial, but the first time we came back, we had to stock up on some things to go shopping, and I remember going down the aisle of a grocery store with my son. I was supposed to get some yogurt or something, and seeing a seemingly endless variety of things to choose from. The choices actually I found a bit stressful. We were quite limited in the things that we could obtain where we lived, and we were quite satisfied with being able to get one type of thing and not have to choose among 50. So life here is more complex. There are more choices. And that was one of the first things that hit me, was just how overrun we are with options.
And now, my final question for you. So you've gotten $500,000 now from MacArthur Foundation. Do you have a sense of what you're going to do with it?
Yes, I do. So it's going to go directly to furthering this work. And what I'm hoping to do with it is that it will provide monetary support for me to put commit more of my time and effort towards the research and the training aspects of what we've been doing. And I'm really looking forward to that. I think it's going to change what I'm able to do over the next 10 years, really.
I've been speaking with Dr. Ben Worf. He's been named a 2012 recipient of the MacArthur Genius Grant for his work in pediatric neurosurgery. Dr. Worf is a neurosurgeon at Boston Children's Hospital. Dr. Worf, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And coming up, we're going to look at the art of business. And I'm talking about logos, those visual references for major entities like Apple and Nike and Starbucks. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio.